Okay, before we begin, the only bit of housekeeping this week is if you have not yet turned in the basic information form to Pam yet, please make sure you do so as soon as possible. Other than that, we're going to jump right in. So, if what Father Justin told me was correct, you completed, was it one or two lectures on the subject of who is God? Was it one? Okay, so one lecture on the topic of who is God. Obviously a big topic, right? A really, really big topic. And so the next in the line is, now that we know a little bit about who God is, we need to know who we are, who is man, and what is creation. So a lot of what we're doing this year, every year we kind of changed up a little bit, but this year we're basing our lectures mostly on Father Josiah Trenum's lectures. Father Josiah Trenum is a priest in California. He has entire series on an Orthodox catechism. The first part and the second part are split up. The second part is really on the Holy Mysteries. And so what we're doing is you could say borrowing. The less kind word is we're committing major plagiarism and just listening to his lectures, but then adding some things to them. And this particular lecture of his is one of his shorter ones, actually. So I actually have a lot to add to it. And as always, I'm going to do my best to actually get through everything that we have to talk about, because there's some things at the end I especially want to cover about kind of what the makeup of man's soul is and how we approach the soul of man. There's a lot of interesting things to go into, but as with any of these lectures, I mean, every little part of this could be a lecture in its own right. So I'll do my best to get through everything, and I'm going to try to leave a little bit of time for questions. I'll do my best to do so, but we got to jump straight in to do that. So Father Josiah starts off with one of my absolute favorite points that he makes, and it's something that I've repeated many, many times in homilies and lectures. And that is that as deep as the mystery of God is, and something you discussed last time, you discussed how deep the mystery of God is. The mystery of God is how deep? What's the word we would use for it? It is infinitely deep. It's infinitely, literally, the mystery of God is something that you can never complete in plumbing the depths of. You'll never end. It's one of these concepts that, because we're created beings, we have no concept of what infinity actually looks like. You know, if I told you that you could have an infinite amount of money, or if I told you that space extends on for infinity, I mean, we have no concept of what that would look like. And within the confines of creation, it doesn't make any sense. So we have to realize that God, as we know him intimately in heaven, our communion with him continually deepens for all eternity. Literally for all eternity. As one saint put it this way, he said, our perfection in heaven will constantly be being perfected. A constantly perfected perfection. Because God's perfection is infinite, and we're constantly growing in God. Which means heaven, one of the things, we're going to talk about this a little bit throughout today, but sometimes for us, heaven is a really terrifying concept. Eternity is a terrifying concept, and it's terrifying because we're using created things and created concepts to try to understand what it's actually like. And the created world that we live in is a fallen world. And so every concept we have is a fallen concept. And we think, boy, a fallen anything for all eternity is just misery. But every saint who's had any experience, St. Paul, of course, talks about this in one of his epistles. But there are many saints who have experienced little foretastes of heaven. They had visions where they said the same thing as he did. Whether I was in the body or out of the body, I don't know. St. Simeon the New Theologian talks about this. One of the most recently glorified saints of the church, St. Joseph the Hesychist, this great monastic figure and ascetic who reposed in 1959, he also had an experience like this. And they always say the same thing. If I wanted to explain it, I couldn't. No matter how hard I could try, human words will never suffice to describe what this is actually like. And one of the important things for us to realize is that heaven is not a static experience. I mean, it's not an experience that doesn't have ebbs and flows and changes. It's a constant movement from glory to glory. Because as you constantly grow in the glory of God, you realize that has no end, literally no end. God is infinitely perfect. And again, it's a concept that we can't fully understand. So if the mystery of God is this great, the point that I like so much from Father Josiah that he starts off with is to say Just as deep as the mystery of God is, so is the mystery of every human being. Because we're made in the image and likeness of God. This is why we spend so long getting to know ourselves. One of the greatest quotes from St. Isaac the Syrian, one of the greatest ascetic saints of the church. Every saint has a great love for St. Isaac the Syrian and his ascetic works. And one of his most famous quotes is, "He who knows himself is greater than he who can raise the dead by his prayers." We spend our entire lives entering and deepening our knowledge of ourselves, entering within ourselves, and going deeper and deeper and deeper. We really don't know ourselves that well. That's why we surprise ourselves all the time. We'll talk about that later as well. I'm sure you've done things in your life where you took a step back and said, "Whoa, who was that? Who I didn't know I was capable of that." Both good and evil, by the way. There are things that we don't even realize we're capable of. We're constantly getting to know ourselves. But in getting to know ourselves, we're actually getting to know our Creator because we're made in the image of God. So, in talking about man and creation in general, the first question that often comes to mind is, well, why was all this created in the first place? Right? What's the great philosopher's question? What is the meaning of life? I never really understood that terminology, the meaning of life. I think I would just say, what's the purpose of life? What's the purpose of everything? And all of that can be found in one fact, that God made everything out of love. The Trinity, which you talked about last time, it's important that God is a Trinity because love has to be given and received. So God can only be love if God is more than one. So the Trinity is this constant exchange of love. And God's love cannot be bound, and so he desired to share it. And so the whole entire reason that he created man was to share his love so that we could live and dwell in it and reflect it, be surrounded by it, be infused with it, to really become his love in a sense. This is the whole purpose for all of creation. We often end up with this spiritual illness where we're unable to conceive of a God who actually loves us. But the fact that we exist means that God loves us. You can't escape that fact. The reason that we have trouble understanding that God really loves us is because we're simply blinded by sin. Sin blinds us to this reality. We get so used to this fallen world and the fallenness of ourselves and everything around us that the idea of this perfect love, this infinite love, that doesn't cease, is a concept that is so unfamiliar to us, we can't even imagine, we can't fathom it. And so the only way to get around that is not for me to try to convince you of God's love so you can think differently about him. You know, when I talked a few weeks ago, we talked about spirituality without anxiety. That's a good step, that whole process I told you about is a good step towards that, you know, believing that God really loves you and accepting it and feeling it in a sense. But to really get to the point where God's love is a true reality for you, an inarguable reality for you, it's not just thinking differently, it's living differently. We have to learn to live apart from sin, because sin, the very definition of sin, is that which separates us from the perfect love of God. That's why overcoming sin is so important in the Christian life. We overcome sin so that we can experience God's love as he intends it to be experienced. And he desires that of us. He wants that of us. We often think of this tyrant God who just wants to beat us up every time we sin. The reality is this is a God who sorrows in our sin because he wants to commune with us. He wants us to experience him exactly as he intends to be experienced. But we have to make sure that we actually accept that love. And to accept that love means you can't have two masters. You can't have two masters. Either God is your Lord and Master, or sin is, and usually sin comes from our self-love. If that's where our focus is, we can't have God as our master perfectly. That's why we're constantly overcoming sin. So when God creates man in paradise, God creates man in a situation that is vastly different from what we understand life to be in this world. Before the fall, man lives in paradise, which has no harm. There's no stepping on a thorn and your foot bleeding. There's no disease. There's no corruption. There's no corruption whatsoever. Things don't wither and die. There's no foul stenches. You know, it's important that you can see pictures of many of the modern saints of the church, right? You can actually look at the pictures and see what they look like in real life. And then you can compare it to the icon. And you can say, okay, that looks a lot like them. But one of the characteristics that you'll see in an icon that's always the same, no matter how the person looked, is the nose. In real life, maybe that person had a very wide nose, but in iconography, the nose is always thinned. It's always thin. Like a good example is we have the icon up there of St. Justin Popovich. You can look at pictures of him and see that he has a wider nose, but in the iconography, his nose is thinned. Why? It's a representation of the fact that in heaven, you only smell certain fragrances. Now you only smell beautiful fragrances. There is no stench of sin, of corruption, of death, of disease anymore. There are no bad smells anymore. It's to show the total transfiguration of the person. And that's what it was in paradise. There was no sickness at all. Adam and Eve literally did not know death. They did not know death. And so God doesn't just create Adam and Eve, but before that, he creates all of creation, all the plants, the skies, the stars in heaven, and all the planets. He creates the waters, the land. He creates all of the animals. And Adam is given this interesting task of naming the animals. It's kind of an interesting thing in creation. He names the animals. To name something in Scripture is to discern its essence. This is why it was so important when Christ would talk to demon-possessed people, he would ask the demon's name. He wanted to know their name and know who he was dealing with. Of course, he knew. He knew before they even opened their mouth. But to know someone's name is to kind of know their essence. And so by Adam naming the animals, he's discerning their essence and why God created this particular animal and how God created this animal to glorify God by serving man. That was the intention of all the animals. St. Ephrem, the Syrian, he has a great commentary on the book of Genesis. It's available in English, by the way, from Catholic University of America Press. He mentions that no animal could lift its head to look at man because the glory of man was too great. Man's face shone like the sun in paradise. This is why so many of the animals are made on four legs. Animals had to bow their head down to man, just like Moses coming down the mountain after receiving the Ten Commandments. You remember that scene? He comes down from the mountain, and the Israelites can't look at him. They literally can't look at him, and they're fearful because his face is shining so brightly. And so he has to put a veil over his face. Otherwise, they were too afraid and they couldn't see him, just like at the transfiguration of Christ. By the way, this was mistranslated. This is really fascinating. This was mistranslated at one point in history. And instead of like rays, they translated it as horns, which is why you can find some Western statues of Moses and he has horns. That's based on a mistranslation of the fact that his face was actually shining. He didn't have horns. So this relationship between man and animals, do we see that today? In general, no, right? In general, animals don't serve man in the same way. Right, I don't know about you, but I can tell my cats to do or not do something they don't listen to well, you know, or geckos or whatever other animals I have. But do we see this sometimes? Do we see this idea of animals serving man? Yes, in the lives of the saints, right? In the lives of the saints, you see man returning to his paradisical state, and so he's so full of grace that what happens? These fallen animals recognize the Creator who intended things to be different. They recognize the Creator in this person, and they start to act differently around them. And so the most famous example is St. Seraphim of Sarov, who had a bear. He had a bear that would come, and he would feed the bear every day. Sometimes the bear would be running towards him, and someone would see it, and they'd say, "Oh, Father Seraphim, watch out, there's a bear coming towards you." He'd say, "What's the big deal? This is my friend. Pet the bear and feed it. No big deal." We have more modern examples of this. Elder Cleopa of Romania. There are two lives of his available in English. There's a shorter one called Shepherd of Souls, and there's a longer one that's a more expanded version of the same one. And that longer one, I want to try to see if I can get in the bookstore because it's so good. It's really, really good. But you can search out that biography, and you won't be able to find this story in there. I'll tell you how I know it in a minute. When he was fleeing from the communists, he would run out into the wilderness, and he was in the mountains. And he also had a bear. He had a bear that would come to him. And every day, he would pick two potatoes. And he'd eat one for himself, and he'd give the other to a bear. And that's how he survived out in the wilderness. The reason I know this story is not because I read it anywhere. It's because my wife's grandmother met him. And this is the story that he told her. He told her about when he was out in the wilderness and what it was like and what he used to do. So he reposed in just 1998. It's a recent figure. Very, very recent figure. Okay. St. Gerasimos had the lion who came to him. The lion who was limping. And so he checked its paw and he found a thorn in it. He took the thorn out. He mended it. And that lion served him the rest of his life. This is not an uncommon thing. A less wild animal. St. John of San Francisco. Anybody know what animal he had that was so close to him? A pigeon. It was a pigeon who used to sit on his windowsill. And when he reposed, it didn't leave there for days. It sorrowed that he had died. You know, this is how we should be with animals. Animals should recognize the glory of God within us and desire to serve man in that way. You know, even the desert fathers, when they couldn't get across the Nile because the waters were too deep and rushing too quickly, they would just look for a crocodile and ask the crocodiles to go side by side so they could stand on the crocodiles and have them go across. We read that today and we think, well, that's crazy. That stuff never happened. But you can look at modern examples of people like Elder Cleopa or St. John of San Francisco, Elder Ephraim down in Arizona. It's a great story of him walking along with one of his monks one day in the desert, and they come across this rattlesnake, and it starts going, and this monk is terrified. The monk who was with Elder Ephraim is terrified of snakes, absolutely horrified. And so he froze. He couldn't move. And Elder Ephraim, just so meekly, he looks at the monk, almost confused, looks down at the snake and looks at the monk. And then he looks down at the snake again. He says, "Can't you see he's scared? Go away. You can come back when we're done." And the snake just bowed its head and slithered away. It was gone. But St. Paisios also had a great love for snakes. He had a great relationship with snakes. This is how animals are supposed to be for us. But of course, with the fall, we lost this relationship with them. You know, animals in paradise didn't eat one another. There was no eating of other animals. Every animal ate only plants. So, one of the things we need to discuss then is what's really the difference between man and animals. What does it mean to be made? Animals weren't made in the image and likeness of God. Man was. We're going to talk a lot about the image and likeness at the end of this, but you know, what does this mean? Why is it important that man was made in the image of God? Well, the fathers talk about how everything that has life, that's a created thing in this world, has a body and a soul, including animals, even plants, they would say, have souls. Life itself is the soul. But those aren't made to be eternal. Will heaven be full of plants and animals? Yes. I mean, St. Paul talks about in Romans how all of creation is yearning for it to be reconnected with God. Not because it's then going to disappear. There will be animals and plants in heaven. But man has a spirit, man has a nous, which is a nous is a word that's you see throughout the scriptures and throughout the fathers, but it's been lost to Western Christianity. A lot of times they translate it intellect, which is not really a good translation because it makes it sound like it's just an intellectual faculty of the mind. It's not the nous. The nous is the aspect of the soul that connects it with things. And a pure nous is one that is constantly in communion with God. This is what we really want. We want a pure nous, which means a pure heart, that is constantly in communion with God, so much so that you see some of the saints who are able to take up their prayer rope, and even without the prayer rope, even while they're sleeping, they're saying the Jesus prayer. People have seen saints sleep, and they say even in their sleep, their lips are moving, and you put your ear close, you can quietly hear them say, "Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me." Even in conversation with one another, their heart never departs from God. That's how man should be. So the pure nous is one that is in connection with God. And so the nature of the fall, the fathers say, was that the nous of Adam and Eve was taken off of God. The focus of their soul, the eye of the soul, was removed from God and placed somewhere else. That was the nature of the fall. Only man has that. So only man's soul is meant to be immortal. By the way, people then, a lot of times we get the question about pets. Well, what about you know, am I going to see Fido up in heaven? I'm sorry to tell you, no, you're not going to see Fido up in heaven, because that soul is not meant to be immortal. Will we see animals? Yes, but the particular souls of animals don't go on forever and ever and ever. It's funny, I asked Father Josiah about this once, it was last year when I saw him. I said, you know, this is a question I get all the time about animals. And he said, first of all, we have to say one thing. He said, isn't it interesting that only in America we get this question? I kind of nodded, I knew where he was going. He said, only in America are we more concerned about our pets than we are about the homeless person starving in the street. He said we should be much, much more concerned about that and every single human being than we should about the animals around us. We have kind of an improper relation with animals. But I have pets, by the way. There's nothing wrong with having pets. But you know what's the typical example I give is, look at most of these Hollywood movies. I remember the first time I really took notice of this was the movie Independence Day. Remember that was with Will Smith? The aliens come and they start blowing everything up. And his character's family is running to safety in this big tunnel. And they kind of wrench the door open and they get into the little alcove and they're ready to close the door. And the little boy says, whoa, what about our dog? And the dog is running and all these explosions are happening behind it. And suddenly the dog gets in at the last minute and they shut the door. And the whole audience is supposed to breathe this big sigh of really, oh, thank God. But all the while, there's millions of people dying in the background. And we're supposed to go, oh, big deal. At least Fido was saved. this is kind of how we view these things. No, animals don't have this immortal soul that's going to continue on forever. But there will be animals and there will be plants in heaven. These things will exist, but in a glorified state, in the way that they were originally intended. So, getting back to man and his creation. Man was created as a communal being. We see this right with the creation of Adam, right? It's not good for man to be alone. Man is supposed to be a communal being. Why? Because he's made in the image of God. And God is a communal God. Again, it's one nature in three persons, three hypostases. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So the communal nature of God is meant to be within man. Man is supposed to be necessarily connected to God at all times, like we just talked about. His noose should be constantly focused on God, which is why the whole process of the church is the cleansing of the noose and the setting it aright so that we can be constantly focused on God again. And this means that in this world, no topic, if all of creation is meant to be in communion with God, there's no topic that we can bring up that has a disconnect from the topic of God. Everything goes back to God. Nothing makes sense apart from God. Father Josiah in his lecture mentions this really important aspect about the fact that we call these colleges universities, but he goes, it's a complete misnomer. They're not universities anymore. If it's a university, then there should be some universal concept that connects every department. Mathematics, religious studies, philosophy, history. It doesn't, you know, sports, medicine, doesn't matter what it is. Everything should go back to one topic, and that topic should be God. But what we've done is we've completely flipped this on its head and tried to get rid of God as much as possible. And we reduce God back to this philosophical concept. And if you don't take a religious studies course, you don't talk about God, period. It's the complete opposite intent of the university. We really shouldn't call them universities anymore. Every topic that we bring up should go back to God, which is why there's no topic that is somehow inappropriate for the pulpit. It's something that I've been accused of that myself, of bringing up things that were inappropriate for the pulpit. Now, are there things that we shouldn't bring up for the pulpit for various reasons? Like, you know, Paul, I'm not going to tell you how to vote. Politics should remain out of the pulpit. But the problem with saying that is, politics tries to take over every issue of humanity, right? There's not an aspect of our lives that isn't touched by politics today. So in my last parish, I gave, you know, homilies on, like, abortion or on what proper marriage is. And people said, well, you know, Father, you really shouldn't get political from the pulpit. I said, marriage? Marriage isn't a topic we should be talking about? Life isn't a topic we should be talking about? If anything, it's politics that have stolen these things from the religious dialogue, not the other way around. Everything goes back to our relationship with God. Absolutely everything. And nothing makes sense apart from God. I had my spiritual father back in when I was in seminary. They had at their church, they had this very small school. It was a small private school for elementary school age kids. And at the beginning of the school year, the priest made a, just a, it was very simple, but it was a beautiful little comment when the kids were about to start math class. They're about to start math class. And he said, you know, a lot of times people ask, when you get to more advanced mathematics, they say, am I ever going to use this in life? And he said, does that really matter? Does that really matter? He said, here's what you're learning. You're learning that God has created an order to things, and there's an order and a balance to everything that he created. And that balance goes in the most intricate ways into all of nature and everything that he made, even numbers. It's a beautiful little thought. It's a beautiful thought. You know, are you going to use advanced calculus in your life? You may. You probably won't. But that can still teach you something deeper down. Elder Sofroni, another figure who's, I think he's going to be glorified very soon. I don't know if he has been. Elder Sofroni of Essex. He used to send all of his monks to a theological school in Paris. And the theological school wasn't always the most traditional. There were some professors there who were known to teach some kind of strange things. And he said, it doesn't matter. He said, take church history. Even in a bad church history class, at the very least, you can learn how God works through the flow of history. You may not get every detail right, you may not get every opinion right, but at least you can see how God is constantly working, even as things are going well, things are going terribly, through disasters, through this, through wars, through all this different stuff. He said, you can always look for God in every topic that you're studying. It was a beautiful thought. So when we do the opposite of this, when we take God away from these topics that we study, and especially from man, what we really do is we actually dehumanize ourselves. We dehumanize ourselves. What do I mean by that? I was listening to a radio program once. It was Orthodox. It was one of these podcasts, and the hosts said something really, really profound. They said, if man is made in the image of God, and God is love, then a person who does not love ceases to be truly human. If we're going to be truly human, we also have to be truly divine. We have to take that aspect of love within us. So when we separate ourselves from God, what we're actually doing is making ourselves less than human. This is why some of the prayers that you'll read in the church, they talk about how I've become worse than a man. I've become more like a beast. This is how we are. We'll talk about this more at the end when we get there, which I'm really going to have to rush to get to. But we have, really, sin is a parasite, according to the fathers. It's parasitic. Okay? So there's a statement that you hear all the time, and maybe you've said it yourself. You know, you do something wrong. So, well, I'm only human. Theologically, that's an incorrect statement. Theologically, that's a completely incorrect statement. The correct statement would be, I just acted less than human. A lot of times we make that statement just so we can make an excuse for what we've done. That isn't good in and of itself. But theologically, it also shows that we don't have an understanding of what it truly means to be human. When we look at the saints and we look at their lives, I had heard a priest say this once. He was talking about the lives of the saints. Somebody was kind of decrying the fact that they weren't like that. And he said, you have to understand, you know, we're not all like that. The saints aren't just human. They're like superhuman. He had it dead wrong. He had it dead wrong. The saints are the most human among us. They live how we're supposed to be. We should be striving to be like them. We're striving for that existence. It's not an extraordinary existence that they have. Rather, it's the existence that God intended for us at the beginning. It's exactly what he meant for us to have. The fact that we don't have that means that something is abnormal in our lives. And we have work to do. This is why the patristic definition of a person, by the way, if we're speaking with theological precision, the fathers say we're human beings, but we're not persons. A human being is body and soul, but a person, as God intended, is body, soul, and grace. Grace should be an integral, essential part of our makeup. How we live, how we think, how we breathe, everything we do ought to be something that helps us partake in and be a product of the grace within us. That's what it means to be truly human. So what we've done is we've replaced grace with sin. Grace, which we get through perfect communion with God, We've now removed that communion with God by turning away from him, and we've replaced grace with sin. We see that the call for man is very high, like I just talked about. It's as high as the saints are, in the fact that God created man last. You may think, well, if man's going to be exalted, he would be created first. No, no, no. God prepared his palace first, and then he enthroned his king and queen of creation, Adam and Eve. He created their palace first. He set everything up for them first. And man then becomes a microcosm, something the fathers talk about. St. Maximus the Confessor talks a lot about this. Man is a microcosm. What does it mean to be a microcosm? It means that all the created realities around us, both physical and spiritual, are contained within the heart of man. Everything is contained within the heart of man, which is why man's both a microcosm and a mediator. How does creation around us find its union back with God? It can't do it itself. It doesn't have the same consciousness. You know, a bird doesn't know that it fell away from God. It knows something's not right. But how does it find its perfect union with God once again? Through man. And that's why we see those stories of the animals with the saints. And it's not just the animals. It's even the plants. St. Irene Chrysovolunta, this great, great monastic saint. She's incredible. When she would pray, the trees at her monastery would bend inwards and bow towards her. That's how nature should react to man. One priest I know put it this way. He said, to be in the presence of St. Paisios, he said, the only way I can describe it is you could feel the grass growing around you. That's the experience we ought to have. That's what we're shooting for. So God creates man as the crown of his creation. And he creates man with this great wisdom. All these other animals, we'll actually talk this tomorrow's gospel, we'll talk about this, the woman who is bent over. All of these other animals are down near the ground, whereas man is placed high. I meant to grab one of the baptismal books so I could read you one of the prayers. One of the prayers for tonsure. At baptism, you're actually tonsured. A little bit of your hair is cut. If we don't like it, we just shave it. I'll shave one line down the middle. Just kidding. It's this idea that everything that we have, God has given us. And so what do we have to give God back? Nothing but the hairs in our head. And so you offer your hairs back and they're burned in the censer. And there's a beautiful prayer, I forgot to grab it, but it talks about the wisdom of how man was created with the head as the highest spot. And everything's created in a man so that in a way such that man can properly glorify God throughout all his life. This is the creation of man. In creating man with this crown of glory at the end of his creation, man doesn't cease, however, to be a dependent being. We're dependent not only on one another, but especially on God. And that means that our dependence on God continues even until today, at this very second, right? We have this unfortunate idea floating around that God created the world. It's kind of a deist idea. God created the world, and then he said, well, I'm going to leave you to yourselves. And he takes a big step back, and he's not involved with us. He's not here present with us all the time. And that's why often we pray in this way. It's like with the sense that God is somehow distant, and we're begging God to somehow come near to us. And every time there's a miracle, we're like, okay, God came near to us, or at least for that second he came near to us, and then he's gone again. That's not the way we view it at all. God is present all the time. The very fact that you continue to exist means that God is present. If you continue to breathe, God is present. God is actively making that happen. Without that, without God's presence, we wouldn't be able to do these things. We would cease to exist, period. We would just cease to exist. This is why one of the reasons I tell people that despair is never allowed in the Christian life. If you're despairing, you think there's no salvation for you, there's no hope for you, my first question to you is, do you still exist? If you're still living, then God must think that there's still a chance for you. Otherwise, you just disappear completely. You die right there on the spot. The fact that you're living and breathing means that there's still hope for you. That's why we never despair. So as God continually is with us in this, it means that man has this central impulse for faith and for religion. And this is why you can take a people who have never heard of the Christian God and always find some sort of religious impulse in them. And it's interesting, today there's a big push against that. There's a big push for secularism. But if you really study secularism closely, guess what you're going to find out? secularism is a religion in itself. It is based largely on faith. You see this all the time. I've watched a lot of debates with atheists. And it's funny, you get them to this point where it's like, how impossible is it for this world to exist and for us to be here today and for us to have consciousness and all this different stuff? And what it comes down to is they always say, well, yeah, I mean, it is, like, statistically it's basically impossible, but they either come up with one of two answers. Either there's an infinite number of universes and we just happen to be in the one that worked. No evidence for that, but we have faith that it's true. Faith. Or they say, they just say, well, yeah, as statistically impossible as this is, it is. It just exists. The fact that it's here means that it can happen. And so I just have faith that if you leave material things to run into each other at hundreds of thousands of miles an hour and there's explosions, eventually after millions of years, this will all result. And that's faith. It's faith. You can't escape faith. Faith is going to be there no matter what. But when you leave people without these ideas, you can see that there's this central idea of a God. There's always an idea of a God. You know, there's a lot of psychologists who try to push this idea that what we're really doing is just, we're just trying to create this cosmic father figure as a crutch. So we have somebody to blame things on when things don't go well. And it's as simple as that. But anybody who's studied this stuff in any depth whatsoever finds out it's never that simplistic. It's never that simplistic. There's something within man that just tells us that we're here with a reason. It's one of the reasons whenever I do church tours, I do it with a lot of school groups, the first thing I ask them is, if it were possible to take a pill that would make you immortal, you could live in this world forever, would you do it? And nobody ever raises their hand. Nobody ever raises their hand. And the question is, why? And they always go back to the same idea. This isn't the way we're supposed to be living. The world isn't the way it's supposed to be. It's one of the fascinating things when you talk to atheists about this stuff. They talk about the disease and the death and the destruction around us as somehow being bad. If it's bad, then it's not supposed to be that way. There's a way that it should be. But how can there be a should if there's no purpose to creation? The only way that there's a way that things should be is if there's a purpose to creation in general, which means inwardly we understand right off the bat, things are not the way they should be, and that means there must be a creator somewhere. There must be a God out there somewhere. So we know this. We know that there's a God out there who has a relationship with us. We're dependent on him, and we're supposed to have a communion with him. And the fact that we don't have a communion with him means that something is wrong. Something's wrong. So God infuses himself into this world, into the spiritual realities, and into the physical realities. It's why we have so many holy objects in the church. It's why we kiss icons, we kiss the cross. A lot of Protestantism has lost this idea. They've become almost Manichaean in their way of looking at things. The Manichaeists believe that there was the spiritual things were the good things and the material stuff was the bad stuff. And so while in a Protestant church, I remember, you know, growing up, we went to one church that had nothing but one cross up on the wall. But it was just a cross. It wasn't called the Holy Cross. It was just the cross. We take the cross and we venerate it. We don't put neon lights behind it and dancing around and all this other kind of crazy stuff. For us, it's a holy object. And that's why when man struggles for salvation, it's not just his soul struggling, it's soul and body. Our entire self, when we step into church, when we go up into that building, should be inundated with this message that this is a time and a place for worship. Every sense is covered. You hear the chanting. You see all the icons and the candles. You touch the candles. You taste God in communion. Everything tells you that your whole body is there to worship. This is why we do prostrations, by the way. Prostrations are a great position of humility, to bow down with your head all the way down to the ground before God, to lower yourself before him in humility. But it's also this reality of making our bodies a participating force in our worship. We don't just worship in soul, we worship in body as well. And when a soul leaves a body, the grace that filled that person does not leave with the soul. It remains with the body. You see this in the Old Testament. You can take the body of a prophet and put it on a dead man and he raises back to life. And this is exactly why we venerate relics. It's exactly why we venerate relics. You go and kiss these relics because the grace of God remains inside of the bodies of the saints. Now, we don't just venerate relics, by the way. When somebody dies in the Orthodox Church, what is the last act of communion we have with them physically?
Kiss.
Kiss. The proper thing to do is you go and you give them, every person lines up, always an open casket, and you kiss them. I'll tell you, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen was in Jordanville, Holy Trinity Monastery and Seminary, the Russian Seminary. I was there when their Archbishop, Vladika Lavra was his name, when he reposed. When he reposed, something really awesome happened, by the way. They didn't know that he had reposed at that moment, but in San Francisco, at the church where the relics of St. John of San Francisco are, in the middle of the night, the bell started to ring. And the priest got a little bit flustered and said, "Who in the world is ringing the bells in the middle of the night?" And they all rushed to find out who was ringing the bells. And there was nobody there. The bells were ringing on their own. And then they got news that Vladika Lavra had reposed. And the bells began ringing at the very moment that his soul left his body. He was the one responsible, by the way, for reuniting Rokor, the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia, with the Moscow Patriarchate. And you know how that happened? They had a big synod of bishops from both sides, and they couldn't agree on whether to reunite or not. And they decided that they would pray about it and write their prayers down on a piece of paper, each individually, and place them under the relics of St. John. And the next day, they got together and had the vote again, unanimous in favor of union. So Vladika Lavra had a great love for St. John, and apparently St. John welcomed into heaven with the ringing of the bells. It's pretty awesome. But anyway, when I was there at Jordanville when he reposed, one of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen, all of these Russian women were taking their children who were running up and were excited. They almost had glee to be able to kiss the hand of their bishop one last time. His body was lying there in church. It was hands crossed with a cross in one of them, and they'd kiss the cross and then kiss his hand. No child was fearful of this. No child kind of shuddered at it. They were excited to be able to kiss their bishop, their spiritual father, one last time. And they were pushing each other aside to try to get there and kiss. You know, the moms are telling, be respectful, be pious, No, I want to kiss him first. That's how we should be. That's how it should be. Okay, so we've talked a lot about how man was in paradise. You're going to talk about the fall a lot in another session, but I can tell you, and you already know, that things are quite different now than when they were in paradise. Sin changes everything, okay? And we talked about how all of creation is connected to man. Man is the microcosm and the mediator. So when man falls, all of creation around him falls as well. And suddenly you have things that were never intended for creation. You have earthquakes, floods, fires, storms. You have thorns that can pierce your skin. You have animals starting to eat one another and trying to prowl after man himself. God doesn't cease, however, in all of this to be personal. He continues to be personal. And he creates the world in a way that he continues to work in his creation even after the fall. And this continues to be the norm for us. God continues to work through creation. One of the things that Father Josiah mentions, I've mentioned this in homilies before because I loved this point so much, it's so important, is that just like we were talking about, often we view God as being very distant, and when some miracle happens, that we view as the hand of God. Father Josiah mentions this story of the prophet Elisha, Elijah's disciple in the Old Testament. And he's out by a river one day, and a man is using an axe, and when he goes to swing the axe, he raises it up, and the axe head flies off and falls into the river. And he's really disturbed by this, not because he had some great love for the axe, rather, he borrowed that axe from a friend. And he doesn't know what to do. And so Elisha comes, and he prays, and suddenly this metal axe head floats to the top of the water. And Father Josiah noted, he said, if we have the proper outlook on this, we see God as just as present in the sinking of the axe head as he was in its rising up and floating. God is just as present in both of these things. It's just that God has an order to creation. There are things that work a certain way. This is how God ordered things. Sometimes he works outside of that order, and that's what we call a miracle. But just because things are working according to their order doesn't mean that God isn't present. God is just as present in both situations, and this is the proper way to understand things. St. John Chrysostom has a beautiful line where he's talking about all the people who would leave Constantinople in order to go to the Holy Land and venerate the holy sites. Pilgrimage is a good thing, by the way. You know, I recommend you do pilgrimage, not just to the Holy Land, but to holy monasteries and churches and things like that, to the relics of saints. Of course, that's a good thing. But he says, don't think that that's the only way that you can somehow get into contact with Christ. He says, don't you know the greatest pilgrimage is the entering in to your own heart? That's the greatest pilgrimage. That's the pilgrimage we should all be making daily through repentance. So nature has an order, but that order doesn't negate the presence of God. That presence of God we got to find in everything, in ourselves and in everything around us. Well, St. Porphyrius had an interesting one. This sounds really hippie. This sounds super hippie, but he said the energy of God can be found especially in nature. So he said, if you find yourself feeling really down and feeling really sluggish and have no energy, he said, go hug a tree. Go hug a tree and you'll feel the energy of the tree and it'll energize you, and then you'll have more energy to continue your struggle. It's a beautiful thought when you take it out of the hippie idea. So God continues to reveal himself to us, and he reveals himself to us in two ways. Through supernatural revelation, that's what we would call the miracles, that's what we would call, you know, the saints, and through natural revelation. So supernatural revelation occurs when God works outside of his normal ways, as we just discussed. But natural revelation is the fact that we can find God in the fact that of nature around us. You know, when you see a beautiful sunset, or you go to the Grand Canyon, or see the mountains even here, there are times when you look at those and you think, my goodness, the beauty that exists there is not by accident. It can't be by accident. One of the things the great theologian, Romanian theologian, Father Dumitru Staniloae, is one of the greatest theologians of the 20th century. There were times in his life where he would look at nature and its grandeur and its beauty, and he would just sigh and shake his head. And he would say, paradise wouldn't be paradise if this weren't included. God will renew all of creation. All of creation will be renewed and placed in paradise. The saints talk about, especially St. Maximus the Confessor, talks about how the more holy we become, the more we delve into the mystery of God through repentance, the more nature reveals God to us. God is revealed more and more through nature to us. We can blind ourselves to this fact. And we see that happen all around us. People blind themselves to this fact. They're not in awe of nature. But the more of a holy life you live, the more you begin to see God in everything around you. So God continues to reveal himself through these things, if we pay attention. You have to pay attention. So because God continues to be present in everything, and because nothing makes sense apart from God, we have to watch out from certain things. We have to watch out for individualism, an individualistic society. America tends to be very individualistic. It's not a positive thing. We talk about the individualism that America puts forth, but that's not the way the country actually began. It actually began the opposite way. Alexis de Tocqueville talks about in his book Democracy in America how he was so in awe of Americans because he was at this town once where they had a big bell tower. And the bell tower fell apart. The bell fell to the ground and the whole thing was just in ruins. And he was so in awe because he said nobody waited around for somebody to petition some government somewhere to fix this thing. The people all just simply got together and decided to fix it themselves. And within a couple of days, it was fixed. That was the individualistic American spirit that we originally talked about. How Americans would band together, and they were always close to one another. There was something called community. We don't have a sense of community anymore. I don't know anybody who really knows every one of their neighbors anymore. It's one of the reasons, you know, we're really happy with the neighborhood we're in. It's why we moved from one house on one side of the street to another house on the other side of the street, you know, when we were trying to buy a house. We really liked the neighborhood because people do know each other. There's a little bit of a sense of community. There's, you know, community, you know, block parties and things like that. But really, the church has become the center for community. We've really lost a sense of what community means, you know, and that's why we have to kind of manufacture it. That's why it's important for all of you, by the way, to get to know one another and invite each other over. You can't have the church always being the one to initiate those contacts. You should initiate the contacts and have that communion with one another. So we have to watch out for improper individualism, anarchy, you know. The scriptures are very clear that God is involved in the rulers of nations. The rulers of nations are important for us, and they should be in communion with God. this idea of having no ruler whatsoever is actually not the proper thing. It's interesting, when you look at monasteries and you look at the ideals of communism, not that far apart at first sight. But then you realize that communism does one thing that the monasteries don't. They take God out of the picture. And when you take God out of the picture, what happens? It ends up with a vision of this utopian thing where everyone shares everything in common, there's no private property, everything, to complete tyranny. And it always ends up that way. It always ends up that way. So it's one of the fascinating things in history is, it's a sad, sad chapter in our history, but if you know about the Jonestown Massacre, everybody know about that? The pastor, Jim Jones, and he went down South America, Guyana, and he sets up this big thing called Jonestown. And there are some people who still claim that that was some Christian cult. If you look at his preaching, it had nothing to do with Christianity whatsoever. He would throw the Bible on the ground and say, don't try to find God there. Try to find God in yourselves and know that really I'm God. I'm your God. And he said that their goal was to set up a perfect communistic society without God. That was his goal. And what ended up happening? It was interesting. You know where they were trying to go? They weren't trying to go to South America. Do you know where they were trying to go? Anybody know? Soviet Union. They kept petitioning the Soviet Union to accept them. They thought, that's the ideal society. That's how things should be. We want to get there. But their petition kept being denied. And so they said, well, if they want to take us, we'll just set up our own. The exact same thing that happened in the country of Russia happened at Jonestown on a much smaller scale. The exact same thing. Instead of equality, you had this tyrannical leader who looked down on everyone and eventually killed everybody. Insanity. When you take God out of the situation, everything falls apart. Everything falls apart. We see this again and again and again. I went to a lecture by a fairly well-known commentator once. I won't tell you who it was. But he gave a very good talk. And at the end, I asked him, if you could sum up what you think the problems are in our country in just like one or two concepts, what would it be? And he said, it's simple. It's the loss of God. And it seems so simplistic. It seems so simplistic. But when you get down to it, that really is, that's the cause of all of our woes. We've tried to take the creation that God has given us, and we've tried to become the lords and masters over it without God. And in doing so, everything falls apart every time. You cannot find an example where that does not happen. So all of creation is theocentric, we would say. God is at the center, and it's there to please God. Nature was meant to please God by serving man. And man was to use nature to glorify God. That's how it was supposed to be. The fall changed all of that. Higher than just being made in the image and likeness of God, God actually desires us to go beyond that and to be his friends. It's another concept that's really hard to understand. This is what we see Christ do with the disciples near the end of his life. I no longer call you my servants, I call you my friends. We want to be friends of God. You see this with some of the saints who become really bold in their prayer, and they argue with God. You can argue with God pridefully. That's not a good way to do it. Why, Jesus, God? Why? That shows no trust in God. But these saints, man, St. Jacobus of Evia, when he wanted somebody to be healed, he would demand that God heal them, and he would tell God, I'm not going to leave this spot and continue praying until you heal this person. And it would happen again and again and again. This is what God calls us to be his friend. This is what we're called to in heaven. And this is what we were supposed to have in paradise. In paradise, man was created imperfectly perfect. He couldn't be made absolutely perfect because then he would have no choice in sin. But he had that one step to go for perfection. And he chose the other way. And this is when life becomes unnatural. We become unnatural. And this is how we exist. We live in an unnatural existence. We live in an unnatural world. What we call natural now is actually unnatural to what God intended. So we have to make sure that we don't project our unnatural way of existence either back to paradise and think we understand it, or into heaven and think that we understand it. These things are way beyond what we can possibly understand. The glory that awaits man is beyond all unnatural conception. And it's really beyond all human words, which is why all these saints who experience a foretaste of heaven always end up saying the same thing. No words will ever suffice. I couldn't explain it if I tried. But the reality is that all that God is by nature, man will become by grace. That's the patristic dictum. all that God is by nature, man will be by grace. So one of my favorite lines in all of Scripture is from Romans 8. St. Paul is talking about there about how we are heirs and co-heirs with Christ. Co-heirs with Christ. He says, so that we'll be glorified with him so long as we suffer with him. What does it mean to be an heir? An heir is one to whom all will be given. The Father will give all to the heir. Everything that the Father has will be given to the Son. That's what it means to be an heir. And we're called co-heirs with Christ. Everything that the Father has given the Son, he will give to us by grace. We will be not just like God, but in a sense we will be God. Now, some people shudder at this and they think, well, in a Mormon sense, not in a Mormon sense, and not in essence either. We're not going to be like, it's not going to be like Father, Son, Holy Spirit, Father Paul. That's not what it is. But rather, God will dwell so prevalently within myself that like when you meet a saint, it's like you can't distinguish God from the person anymore. By their choice, by the way. St. Paul says, it's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. Which means to talk with St. Paul is to talk with Christ. Now, St. Paul never loses his sense of personhood. That's why he can, even though he says, I no longer live, but he still uses the word I. It's interesting. But if we understand what God has awaiting for man, we should be scandalized. You've heard me talk about this already. We should be scandalized by that concept, that we're co-heirs with Christ. I was telling that to one man who was bedridden, very, very sick, and I was trying to describe this to him. And he said, I'm sorry, but it sounds like blasphemy. And I said, you get it. Good. It does sound like blasphemy. This is the glory that God awaits for us. Everything that God is by nature, he will give to us by grace. This is the union he seeks with us. This is the glory of man. This is how much man is crowned. And this is what we're called to. We should never forget the glory that we're called to. So we talked about how man is made in the image and likeness of God. The image of God is an interesting concept because the fathers all give, they give very different ideas as to what the image of God within us is. There's no one set definition. That's okay. So there's nothing wrong with that. It just shows us that the image of God is very multifaceted within us. Right? Consciousness is part of the image of God. Okay? Our creative nature, that's one of the fathers talks about that, the fact that we create shows that we're made in the image of God. There's a lot of things that go into the image. But the whole entire spiritual life is about cleaning off the image of God, which each of us retains, and regaining the likeness that we lost in the fall. That's what happened in the fall. The image was stained over and the likeness of God was lost. And so we're seeking to regain the likeness of God in everything that we do. That's what the whole church exists for. If sin is like a parasite and the church is a hospital for the sickness of sin, then the whole purpose of our existence within the church is to rid ourselves of the parasite and to reunite ourselves with God so that we become like him once again. And those are the saints that you can look at when you meet them. And I've met people like this where you look at it and say, oh my goodness, if this is what the love of God is, if this is what the glory of God is, I want this too. There's something so pure and so magnificent and so glorious about it. So I want to talk to you just a little bit more as we finish up, just about the makeup of the human soul and how it is we go about this. Because the human soul has parts. Just like the body has parts, the soul has parts. Okay, so I have a little handout for this. Okay, would you mind? Thank you. This is something I wrote up based on a book called The Spiritual Life and How to Be Attuned to It. It's by St. Theophon the Recluse. Let me tell you about St. Theophon in just a second. You know that Father and I have about 6 dozen more books that we like to put on the catechumen reading list that we're not going to overwhelm you like that. But St. Theophon is one that it's kind of a shame that we don't have him on there. We just don't want to overwhelm you. But there's a book called The Path to Salvation. Everybody should read it. Everybody should read The Path to Salvation. It's St. Theophon basically taking all the wisdom from the fathers and saying, okay, step by step from baptism on, how are we saved? How are we sanctified? And he goes through the whole process. And he has another book, this one called The Spiritual Life and How to Be Attuned to It. And it's one I also highly recommend, but I always recommend it with a major addendum. And that addendum is, and I think Pam can tell you about this, right? The first 13 chapters make you not want to read it. Yes? Yes. The first 13 chapters are tough. These aren't really chapters. They're actually letters that he wrote to somebody. And they're beautiful. And they're incredible. But the first 13 chapters, he spends talking about the makeup of the soul and how we live our lives and what are the options for living our lives. And so I did this with a reading group that I had in my first parish in Cincinnati, and they were so confused every week that I wrote up a summary of the first 13 chapters on this one page. And this one page kind of summarizes everything. So if you're going to read the book, which I recommend you do, read it with this. Keep this page. And if you lose it, just write to me and I'll send it to you. But keep this page if you can, and it'll kind of summarize everything, and then it gets a little bit easier from then on out. So on that left side, he talks about the fact that there are three ways that we can live. You see, and think about people in your life. Think about yourself and how you can fall in different times in your life into one of these three categories. The highest way to live is the spiritual life. We ought to live spiritually. To live a spiritual life is a life lived seeking union with God and thus focusing on the health of the soul. It is characterized by the fear of God, by listening to one's own conscience in order to do God's will and follow the commandments, and by a longing for God. This is life in the truest sense, life as it was intended. This is how man ought to be, longing for God, constantly in communion with him, but seeking greater communion with him all the time, and constantly yearning for him. St. Porphyrius was a great example of this. St. Porphyrius, people would walk next to him, and they'd be confused. They'd say, you know, I was taught to say the Jesus prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, the sinner. Or even the short version, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. He said, all I hear is you saying, Jesus, my Jesus, Jesus Christ, Jesus, my Jesus. It's all you would say. And he would kind of smile and he'd say, at the beginning, yes, the Jesus prayer. But he goes, when you get to a certain point where your love for God burns so greatly in your heart, just his name alone, envelops your whole being with his love. And you obtain him more and more every time you say it. His Jesus prayer became just the name Jesus said over and over again. By the way, most people wouldn't have to ask him that. He would know what they were thinking and he would answer their question before they asked. That was St. Porphyrius. He did that all the time. If we're not living the spiritual life, we might be living number two, which is the intellectual life. This is a life lived in pursuit of knowledge, logic, and the sciences. It raises the life of the mind above all else and is often characterized by the empty wandering of thoughts. Do we see people in society who could be described as living this type of life? Absolutely. All over the place. And if you're not living like that, wait till you get to number three, the sensual life. This is life lived for pleasures and comforts. It is also almost subhuman, for it focuses on food, sleep, sex, and entertainment. The soul in this life is subject to the desires of the body. The body thus rules the soul. Do we see people living like this around us? Absolutely. I mentioned that we're always learning about ourselves. I think it's one of the most ironic things of our society that we say that kids should go to college in order to find themselves. When kids go to college, which type of life do they live? The sensual life. Are you going to find yourself living the sensual life? You are going to lose yourself, not find yourself. It's exactly the opposite result. So the way that we ought to live according to the spiritual life, number one, is that God ought to be head of everything. And the God ought to be the God of our soul, and the soul ought to lead the body. That's the properly ordered man. God is above me, my soul leads the body. But we live life flipped. The body and the desires of the body come first, way over the needs of the soul, and then God is barely an afterthought. Guess what helps correct this? Fasting. Very good. This is the greatest answer to why we fast. There's a lot of answers to why we fast. But the main answer that I give is that it helps correct this. God gave us a command in the church to fast, and I want the needs of my soul to be met before the needs of my body. That's also why fasting should always be combined with prayer. Fasting and prayer always go together. Okay, so moving on to that right side of the page, you see this image of the soul. I told you the soul is divided into parts. Okay, this comes from philosophy. But the fathers Christianized it. They said that the philosophers, they didn't get everything wrong. They had seeds of truth in everything they said. But they needed to be corrected in some areas. And so this is the soul. The soul has the intellect, the active part, or the will, and the sensual part, or the desirous part. Now, on the left side, you see what that part looks like when it's fallen. And on the right side, you see what it's when it's sanctified, or what we call in its natural state, as God intended it. So the intellect, what happens with a fallen intellect? The mind is scattered. It lacks focus. It is attracted to and stuck on things of this life. This is, do we see this in our own lives? You know when you see this most? When you pick up your prayer rope and do the Jesus prayer. You're going to find out that your intellect is very scattered, and it likes to focus on everything but Christ. And your mind goes absolutely everywhere, all over the place, and it's shooting left and right all over the place. And to constrain it is a really, really tough thing. And by the way, how do we constrain it? Through prayer. The struggle of prayer actually sanctifies the intellect. This is one of the main reasons we pray as much as we try to, is so we can sanctify the intellect. And what happens to a sanctified intellect? Everything experienced and observed leads to a yearning for the ideal, for the divine. The saints could do this. They could take everything around them and everything would lead them back to God. It was raining really hard one day in Pennsylvania when St. Nikolai Velimirovich was alive. It was raining really hard. And so some of the students were kind of complaining. They said, oh, it's been raining for days and days. And St. Nikolai looked out the window and he sighed and smiled and he goes, yes. He goes, just as the Lord waters the earth with rain, so he yearns to water our souls with his mercy. For him, everything went back to God. Everything went back to God again and again and again. His mind was always on God. He could always take any thought and bring it back to God. The active part, the will. In the fallen state, it seeks to acquire what is pleasant and comfortable. Selfishness often reigns. Does this describe us? I think so. When we sanctify the active part, the will, it desires unselfish deeds and the acquisition of the virtues. So what are some of the things we do to start correcting the will and to sanctify the will? But almsgiving. Almsgiving helps you do this, okay? Anytime we practice selflessness, we put ourselves last rather than first. It's one of the times where you see, you know, anger is a big one. Anger means we're not getting our way. Our will isn't getting its way, so we give way to that. We give way to what other people want and need first. Okay, finally, the sensual part, or the desirous part. In the fallen state, there's a focus on pleasing the senses, taste, smell, touch. It seeks to obtain what is pleasant to the body and to avoid what is not. This is where we get gluttony, love of food. It's where we get laziness, love of comfort, love of our bed, more than love of our prayer corner. Okay? Love of lust. We see this big obsession with pornography in our society, things like that. This is all to show the fallen state of the sensual part, of the desirous part of the soul. What happens when it's sanctified? It takes in what is needed to sustain life. The love of the beautiful predominates all. It seeks what is beautiful, not what is simply physically comfortable and fulfilling. There's this paragraph then. St. Theophon offers a picture of the soul as described by the fathers who preceded him. On the left, we see what a fallen soul, and thus an unhealthy soul, looks like and what it desires. The soul in its natural intended state, the healthy soul, which is described on the right, shows, what our goal is. In this soul, the passions have been transformed into virtues. The soul is rightly ordered, and the desires of the soul are healed and properly aimed. So this is really a little diagram of what we're trying to do all the time in the spiritual life. This is the goal. To sanctify each part of the soul, and to bring it to this sanctified or natural state. And when that happens, God is infused into all, and all of nature, all of creation recognizes it and starts acting differently around you. This is the goal. This is what it means to return back to the paradisical state. And then it's amplified beyond human conception. I mean, more than 100, more than 1,000, more than 1,000,000 times in heaven. This is what man is intended to be. This is the crown jewel of God's creation. We are. So we have a high calling. We have a high, high calling. And are we going to fall short of that? Of course we are. But you know, we have a merciful God for a reason. He's not the courtroom judge who's just sitting there waiting to sentence us. He's teaching us through all this. He's yearning to sanctify us through every step of the way. And then at the very bottom, I put that one line. It says, while this may seem overwhelming and confusing at first, the basic point that St. Theophon calls us to is simple. Follow the commandments and the teachings of the gospel. This is what the way to an ordered, holy life. Everything comes down to that. Everything comes down to that. Why is the world around us falling apart? Because we've forgotten God. How do we sanctify the world? It's not through politics. It's not through philosophy. It's not through arguments at the dinner table. It's not through anything else. It's through following the gospel and following the commandments. That's the goal for everything. That's the cure for everything. That's how we sanctify the world around us. So we have just 5 minutes, but if there's any questions, that was such little stuff. I mean, there's just nothing to ask about. So.
And just a quick comment. I've heard that one of the reasons that story is in the Bible is because axe heads were really expensive in those days. You hear that story and think, oh, an axe, we can go buy an axe for $50 or $100. But an axe head was really difficult to make, really a really expensive piece of technology. So just a
yeah, he was freaking out for a reason. Uh-huh.
So, who is to say that the fall isn't God's will and order? If the axe head falls and is risen by God, then why not the fall being part of his order and will?
Okay, so two things about this. The question was, if the axe head falls and then floats on his will, then is the fall itself, the fall from paradise, not also part of his will? Who's to say it's not part of his will? That's your question? Okay, so first of all, we have to distinguish between the fall as a theological term of falling from paradise and simply an order to creation. Even in paradise, there was an order to creation, right? I'm pretty sure in paradise, my guess would be that the giraffes weren't flying. The birds were flying, and the giraffes weren't. You know, there's an order to the way things were created. And there's an order even in the fallen world. But that order within the fallen world is broken because of sin. And the reason it's broken is because the world has now moved, through man, the world has turned away from God. So our turning back to God is creation's turning back to God, and everything falling back into proper order. So a good example of this is, like I said, you know, in the fall, suddenly now there's storms, there's destructive storms and hurricanes. But what happens when you have a sanctified person? Well, when St. John of San Francisco was in the Philippines with a lot of the refugees there, every single night he would take his cross and he'd go to the four sides of the island, northeast, south, and west, and he'd bless them. And the whole entire time they were there, a storm never went through. They had storms there all the time. They were worried they were going to be killed, or the whole entire encampment was going to be destroyed. Nothing was destroyed as long as he was there. As soon as they left, it was like a day later, a big storm came in and destroyed everything. Destroyed absolutely everything. Okay? So there's still order to creation. But that order is often broken in the sense that there's a disease now within it. It's just like if you have a body, but like we said, you have a parasite. Your body's still there, and things may still be functioning basically how they're supposed to, but some things are just not quite right. Okay? Now, the fall itself, was it God's will that man should fall? We would say absolutely no, because it's God's will that all men be saved and come to knowledge of the truth. God desires that all men be saved. But God gives man free will. And the reason God gives man free will is because he wants the love to be given back freely. If God forces it, it's no longer love. You know, if I tell my kids, you know, you need to take your money and go buy me this and give it to me as a gift. And then they give it to me as a gift and I say, oh boy, look how much they love me. Because they got no, I forced them to do it. It's not a sign of love. It's not an act of love. It has to be a free act. And that's exactly what God intended for man, was for man to show his free love towards God. But man decided to turn away from God. So the fathers are very clear that it was not the intent of God. It wasn't his plan that man should fall, but he knew that he would. Of course, God knows all things, and he knows everything that will happen. He knew that man would abuse his freedom, but he created him nonetheless because of his love. He didn't want to deny all of mankind the possibility of existing and living in his love. So he continues to let man live, even though he knew man would fall. But it wasn't his desire for that to happen. If that was his desire, then he wouldn't have given them the choice to begin with. He would have just cast them out of paradise without giving them the choice at all. But we see he gives them the choice. And by the way, the will is another thing that the fathers talk about as being part of the image of God. We have a free will. And we can use or abuse it. That's a good question. Yes?
Okay, so you know how this talks about selflessness and putting others and putting God above ourselves and our own desires. But as Christians, at what point do we draw the line of like unhealthy people pleasing and mm-hmm. kind of those types of behaviors where it becomes like a cycle of getting taken advantage of, and not in a sense of, you know, you're doing it out of free will, but you feel like you're being treated. Where do you draw that line?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's not one that I can give a There's not a black and white answer to this. I can give you kind of some pointers about what the fathers say about this, because it's an interesting. Hey, if you didn't hear her question was, if we're supposed to be selfless towards other people, at what point do we draw a line? Because our selflessness, our giving to them, may actually be destructive for them. And I think that's the first thing we have to ask is this actually helping or harming the person? In most cases, we really don't have to ask that question. You don't have to ask that in every sense. But there are times when that does occur. I'll tell you that as a priest, I am held to a different standard than parishioners in this. Because if I let you continue on doing something that is wrong, it's actually abusive for you and it's bad for your salvation. And I'm failing as a priest in doing so. Right? So Elder Sofroni has this quote. I was really shocked when I read this. But he said, yeah, the goal of every Christian is humility. But he said, you can't always be humble in front of every person. He said, if you're humble in front of people who are abusive towards that humility, and they see that humility as a weakness, and therefore it encourages them to take more abuse of you, he goes, in that case, it's better to actually stand up for yourself and try to shut that down. So we actually have to be cautious about these types of things. At the same time, I know a very, very holy nun. I mean, she's a living saint. And she has one of my favorite quotes. She says, the Christian should be like the pavement. You let people step all over you, and all you do is hold them up in return. It's a beautiful image. And it's really what we want to aim towards. But we should look at the type of relationship that it's in and where that person is. And some people are just really, really unhealthy. To let them continue on in that can actually be to encourage them. You know, I read that quote from Elder Sofroni. Unfortunately, maybe it was good for me. Maybe I wasn't ready to read it, but I read it after I was in a bad parish situation. And I wish I had read it before, because I would have my response to some people in the parish who were very, very abusive, but also, I mean, they just lived miserable lives. We just talked about this idea that, you know, love has to be given freely. Well, when you're really broken, what you do is you try to control everyone around you because you don't want to be hurt, you know? And so you try to force their love, and you know it's false, but you continue doing so because you're really afraid that you're going to find out they don't actually love you. And I mean, it's a really broken way to live. I wish I would have sat this person down and said, you know what? What you're doing is absolutely ridiculous, and it's sinful, and it's horrible, and you're treating me awfully. And I'm sorry, I don't know what's going on in your life, and we can talk about it, and I'll be glad to help you through it. But I'm not going to allow this to continue. That's what I probably should have done. You know. So again, I don't know that I can give you, there's no black and white, because every situation is a little bit different. And you have to find out what you can do with people. But my typical advice to people is, be bold if you can be bold and loving. If you can't be loving, accept the abuse until it humbles you enough where you can be. But it also doesn't mean that we're masochists. And that means that you don't have to keep yourself in a bad situation. It's okay to remove yourself from a situation. You know?
Fine.
Yeah, well, and that's guess what? That's why we have spiritual fathers. That's why we have spiritual fathers. You go to the spiritual father, and the spiritual father might say, well, you have to, like if somebody came to me and said, you know, my family makes fun of me, and therefore I want to walk away from my family and never talk to them again. Wrong. You know, find a family situation that is perfect, and I'll find you a fantasy movie. It just doesn't exist, you know. But if you're telling me, well, my family not only makes fun of me, but they're absolutely abusive towards me, and they keep stealing my money, okay, let's take a step back right now. like let's actually examine this and see what we can do about this. There is a line there. But you have a spiritual father for that very reason, to help you kind of guide through that. Anything else? Are we ending right on time? 6:01. There's one quote I meant to share and I forgot to. And even though we're a little bit after, I'm going to share it anyway. Just talking about this idea that we really don't know ourselves. I've said that to people and had them be really surprised. And they're, oh, I know myself really well. Do we really? Do we really know ourselves? There was this Southern Catholic writer named Walker Percy. Anybody familiar with Walker Percy? You know Walker Percy? He wrote some really incredible books. I took a class on him actually in college, and I really got to love him. And he wrote a book called Lost in the Cosmos, the last self-help book you'll ever need. And he spends the whole entire first part talking about how we really don't know ourselves. We just really don't know. And he gives a bunch of examples about this. He talks about how, you know, some of them are kind of comical. He says, you know, when you look at a group picture, like somebody gives you a group photo and you know you're in it, the first thing you do is look for yourself. He goes, why do we do that? Don't you know what you look like? Like, do you really need to see yourself? He talks about how sometimes we walk by like a window like a shop window, and we see our reflection, but we don't realize it's us, and we think it's somebody else, and we stop and we actually look, and then we realize it's ourselves, and he goes, shouldn't you know yourself well enough to know you know, who this is without being shocked by it? And this is one of the examples he gives, and I loved this. This was really interesting. He says, why is it that in your entire lifetime you will never be able to size yourself up as you can size up someone else? Or size up Saturn in a 10-second look. Why is it... did I skip? Here it is. I was on the wrong page. The following experiment was performed on a group of 10 subjects. See how you would answer this question. Think of five... Oh, boy, did I get the wrong one? I think I did. Well, I'll read both of them. Think of five acquaintances, not close friends, not lovers, not family members. Describe each by three adjectives. In the experiment, a personality characteristic chart was provided on which one could score an acquaintance on a scale of good and bad qualities. For example, more or less trustworthy, attractive, boring, intelligent, selfish, flighty, outgoing, introspective, and so on. Thus, you might describe an acquaintance named Gary McPherson as fairly good company, moderately trustworthy, funny but a little malicious, and so on. Or Linda Ellison, fairly good-looking, a 7 or 7.5, he says, more intelligent than she lets on, a good listener, and so on. Note that most, if not all, of your adjectives could be placed on a finite scale, say from a plus 10 to a minus 10. Now, having described five acquaintances, do the following. Read these two sentences carefully. A. You are extraordinarily generous, ecstatically loving of the right person, supremely knowledgeable about what is wrong with the country, about people, capable of moments of insight unsurpassed by any scientific or artistic or writer in the or artist or writer in the country. You possess an infinite potentiality. Or B, you are of all people in the world probably the most selfish, hateful, envious. That is, you take pleasure in reading death notices in the newspaper and in hearing an acquaintance's heart attack. The most treacherous, the most frightened, and above all, the phoniest. Now answer this question as honestly as you can. Which of these two sentences most nearly describes you? Check A, B, or C, neither or both. I'm sorry, C is just both. If you checked both, C, 60% of respondents did. How can this be? That's always stuck with me ever since I read that. 60% of respondents said that. And I think in our own lifetimes, we could probably describe ourselves the same way. I'm really virtuous. I'm level-headed. I'm really smart. I'm this, I'm that. I'm great. And at other times, I'm the worst thing to ever walk the face of the earth. I'm dirt. I'm scum. Scum is better than me. And he says 60% of respondents said both. Both could describe them. How can that be? The reality is we have both things within us. We have the image of God still within us, but it's stained over. And so what do we do with that? We can lament over it. We can sit in confusion over it. Or we can use the hospital of the church that Christ has given us and cleanse it. And cleanse it properly. And that's really the only option. So do we know ourselves? Not so well. Not so well. But how do we get to know ourselves? The only way is to learn to know God. It's the only way forward. Okay, forgive me for going over.